Welcome to FemTech at Work, the podcast where we explore the intersection of technology, health, and women's empowerment in the workplace, hosted by me, Maaike Steinebach. This show will dive into the innovative solutions transforming women's health and well-being in the workplace. Join us as we chat with FemTech founders, industry leaders, and change makers who are pioneering advancements in FemTech and women's health. We discuss everything: menstrual health, reproductive rights, menopause, but also the challenges women face in the workplace and how innovation can overcome them. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting your FemTech journey, FemTech at Work is here to inspire and inform you about the future of health and wellness for women everywhere. Tune in and be part of the conversation. Hi, and welcome to this episode of the podcast FemTech at Work with today's very special guest, Eric Yang, who is the co-founder of IntiLabs from Taiwan. Hi, Eric. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Maaike. It's a pleasure.
I'm very excited to be able to talk about your journey and the incredible things that you're doing in the fertility space. So maybe before we kick it off, can you tell me what IntiLabs does and a little bit more about your background and how you came to found the company?
Absolutely. IntiLabs were a company that is working to improve IVF outcomes, things like pregnancy and live birth rate. And we're doing this through a precision testing solutions. Our innovation has shown to boost success rate by about 10 to 15%, which is really, really huge for people undergoing the fertility journey. As an example, one of our first products on the market is Aura. So this test actually helps the patient and the doctor determine when would be the best time to transfer the embryo. So we have seen patients who have failed in the first place and use Aura and find the right time to do that embryo transfer, and it was successful. So this has been really exciting for us. This product is best in class. It's non-invasive, so only a blood draw.
Okay, that was going to be my next question. How does it work? So it's a blood draw, and what does it measure?
So it measures the expression of microRNA in the blood. MicroRNA, if you notice, it's last year's Nobel Prize in Medicine.
Yes.
Was won by the people who discovered microRNA. It's a very stable biomarker in the blood.
Okay, so basically this product or what IntiLabs is doing is not necessarily identifying kind of the good embryos or the good eggs. It is really looking at the optimal time that the mother is able to receive these embryos.
Yes, that's one of our products. And we are also doing some other products that help identify the best eggs, which I can talk about later in the podcast. So we're very excited about this product, or it's non-invasive, it's a blood draw. Whereas our competitors, all the products that they have are invasive. So you have to go in the endometrium, take a biopsy. Besides being a solutions company, we're really beyond products. We also see ourselves as a resource company. We have created a wide range of free educational products, materials to support patients, because we know how emotionally and physically difficult the process is. So I think this material can help patients navigate through this complex process. And believe it or not, these are all free. So we're creating more stuff on our website to help patients.
So Eric, with Ori and this information, so basically you are a B2B2C company, right?
Absolutely. It's a B2B2C.
So with this free information that you are providing, is that part of the offering that the clinicians or the doctors then share, or do patients find you directly for this information when they look up your products?
The patients find us directly. When they look into our website, we will direct them to some of our resources. I hope this materials could help them out.
Yes, I'm sure it is. There is so much misinformation out there. I think it's very important to have solid, useful, real-world kind of information. As you said, this is a very emotional journey and where everybody's looking for knowledge, information, and answers, right?
Right, exactly. So we hope this materials could help them.
But you also have some other products, right?
Yeah, we have two other products that's under development. One is called Opal. It's actually the brainchild of my co-founder, Dr. Barry Bear. It's a product that determines the quality of the egg through its elasticity. Through the entire IVF process, the most important component is the egg. But really, there's no technology to determine the quality of the egg. is a product that we're really excited about that could help us determine the quality of the egg, choosing the best egg for freezing and for the IVF process.
So how do you test that? You said squishiness. How does that work?
That's a nice way to put it. So basically, once the egg's retrieved, we have a device that could assess the egg's squishiness by using a micropipette to making an aspiration to the egg. And that's how we determine its quality. Because the elasticity or the softness or the hardness of a cell, it's correlated to their quality.
Okay, so is it the harder the better or the softer the better? Sorry, I'm a complete amateur here. So I'm very curious now.
It's somewhere in between.
So there is a range upon which the optimal elasticity of the egg should be. And then basically by the ability of your product to identify that, then you know which one to go and freeze and which one to fertilize and which yes. ones you should disregard. Oh, that's amazing.
Yes. Hopefully we get to that point one day. We're still under development. We're going through clinical studies to prove its efficacy. So we're seeing really, really nice results.
Oh, that's amazing. So anything else our listeners should know about the company before we go and talk about you?
One last thing, I really want to share this product that we're developing. It's really exciting. So throughout the entire IVF process, the patient or the woman has to go through numerous, like blood draw. It's time consuming. It's painful. So we are developing something that's confidential with a professor in Hong Kong that could actually detect the hormones levels in the drawn blood to figure out the hormonal level. So this could actually detect, not invasively, like a patch. This could detect several types of hormones level. And that would actually help the patient, help the doctor. You don't have to go into the clinic every day to draw blood. Once you see a change in your hormonal level, you can go in and take the blood, but you don't have to go in every day. It saves time for the patient. It saves time for the doctor. So we're really excited about the product.
Well, it not just saves time. I think it's also, as you said, about the customer journey, right? Yeah. So I think we tend to completely underestimate how much both mental and physical toll this whole process has on women, just from even having the hormonal injections to then going through the ropes. And what I really like about what you're doing and about what the company is doing is really putting the kind of patient or customer first. And saying, hey, how can we take away some of the discomfort, some of the pain, some of the experience to basically make sure that the experience is better, but that the outcome is also better. So technically kind of shortening potentially the process and having better success rates. Is that a good recap roughly of what you're doing?
You're right on point. You could be a spokesperson for the company. In summary, our long-term vision, which is coined by my co-founder, Dr. Barry Baer, is to simplify IVF journey down to one egg, one sperm, one embryo, one implantation, and one successful pregnancy in the most least burdensome way. That's our goal.
So I love that, right? It would be great to have like 1-1-1-1-1 and then just success. The reality is that it isn't. So just based on your experience, why do you think this is such a difficult process?
The entire process is difficult because we don't really know the reason why some women are less likely to become pregnant, even if they're going through the process. There could be numerous reasons. I mean, we know the egg, the embryo, the window that when to transfer the embryo plays a role. Immunology, I would say about 81% of the reason from the male side and the women's side is known, but there's still 20% that's unknown. And the 80%, you still don't have solutions for it. So I think that's the tough part about the journey. Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously you were looking to kind of close that 20% window and kind of make it smaller and smaller. But what I find really interesting is just to hear about you and your co-founder's journey, because I come across a lot of companies that are working on solutions for women's health, and they are women because they have experienced something that they found very painful, uncomfortable, embarrassing, and are really looking to change this for other women. But on the other hand, I also see both men and women, by the way, that are really saying like, hey, this is a massive commercial opportunity because there is such a gap in the healthcare system. And they jump into the women's health space for that reason. Where do you and your co-founder sit? What is your story to start Inti Labs?
I was listening to your podcast and I seen a few male founders.
Yes.
So I'm not alone.
No, not at all. And I think it's super exciting that just like any industry, we need to have as much diversity as possible. But I just love to hear people's background stories as well about it.
A little bit about me. I was born in Hong Kong and raised in Taiwan and moved to the US for college. I did my undergrad in biochemistry and my PhD in molecular biology and biochemistry. That was followed by a postdoc and roles at several startups. So in 2022, I was fortunate to have the opportunity to co-found Inti Labs with Dr. Barry Bear. He's now retired. So he was a professor of OBGYN and the IVF lab director at Stanford for 30 years. So for Barry, this has been a life's work. He's deeply passionate about reproductive biology. He told me when he was in college, the first time he studied about gametes, sperms, and embryos, he fell in love. He got his PhD in embryology and reproductive biology. So that has been his passion for 30 years. Still is. For me, it's a bit more personal. I had children a bit late in my life, in my 40s. And while I was fortunate not to do the entire IVF, I saw close friends struggle through it. That really opened my eyes, you know, how emotionally draining and intense and how medically complex this process is. And I saw a clear opportunity. This IVF's success rate still have lots of room for improvement. And this is a growing space with the potential to truly help people. That combination made it clear for me. And so I reached out to Barry. I known Barry for a while. So I asked him if he wanted to join me. And he's got some idea. He's got this OPO, this egg product that he thinks could make a big difference. And I promised him I'll commercialize this technology for him. And he decided to join.
Amazing. And by the way, you raise a very interesting point because you talk about people, right? So how this affects people. And I think one of the mistakes we kind of made is that we talk a lot about fertility as being a women's health problem. But I think more and more we are also seeing that, you know, men are part of the problem, just the quality of the sperm. But also apart from that, as you rightfully pointed out, I think we are seeing that fertility affects the whole family. Obviously, a lot of women have to go through the very invasive procedures of IVF, but the mental load for a partner and the inability to support or do things and feeling that pressure of also being part of that process, I think is something we are starting to talk about more and more, actually.
Right.
Are you seeing that as well when you speak to patients or to clinicians?
Yes, we actually just conducted an interview for a couple that went through the IVF process and used our product and it was successful. For the women, it's really emotional, but the husband has to be supportive.
Yeah.
And he was. It's a family
thing. Yes.
You have to go into it together. And it's not only the woman. The male also has contributed about 35% of the problem. Sometimes I like to think we men had it. Have it easy. But I think as a husband, as a father, it's a process that both the women and the men has to be involved in and really, really help each other out.
Yeah, exactly. So fertility, obviously, globally is a huge issue at the moment. I think in particular, though, in Asia, we are seeing massively dropping birth rates. And we're also seeing kind of governments scrambling to find ways to convince people to have more children, whether it's financial incentives or schooling or housing, even I saw in Korea. What are kind of the trends that you're seeing in the fertility space in, well, maybe in Taiwan, Hong Kong, or just Asia in general?
You raise a good point. No one's having baby. Young people are choosing not to have baby in Asia. Taiwan has the lowest birth rate in 2024.
Wow.
And that's followed by South Korea. Third on the
list. Oh, I didn't know Taiwan was actually having the lowest. Wow.
Yeah. You know, South Korea and Taiwan are exchanging places
yeah.
every year. So South Korea is second on the list. Singapore is third. Do you know which on the fifth on the list is Hong Kong?
Yeah, exactly. I know Hong Kong is up there.
Yeah. So no one's having baby. So this is a really problem for government. And at the same time, in Asia specifically, across the world, right? But in Asia, infertility is rising. and it's actually affecting younger people. This is very strange what we're observing in Asia. I was recently speaking with a doctor in India who said the observation is girls are starting menstruation as early as primary school in India, which leads to early ovarian aging, which leads to infertility earlier in life. And this is also happening in countries in Vietnam. And combine this with career-driven lifestyle and delayed parenthood, we're seeing more fertility challenge in Asia specifically because of this combination. But at the same time, because of this trend, we're seeing a growing spurt in fertility preservation, such as social egg freezing. It's been growing a lot. I'm seeing that in Taiwan. Clinics are starting to promote egg freezing, and government are actually providing support for egg freezing, and also the entire IVF process. So this is the trend I'm seeing in Asia.
Yeah. Interesting comment you made about the doctor in India about girls starting menstruation earlier. Do we know why?
Not sure. There was a book previously written by a professor in New York. I think that environmental pollution are causing a lot of problem. For example, since 1974, sperm count have halved. And this is mostly due to the chemical pollution in the environment. So no one knows the reason. But yeah, we're seeing this trend in India, and also we're conducting clinical trials in Vietnam. We're seeing patients as early as 25 seeking treatment. And it's not just one or two. I mean, we're seeing a lot.
Wow, that is very worrisome. Oh God, now I have many questions that I need to figure out how to ask you. So you also mentioned obviously about the trend that egg freezing is more popular. Interestingly enough, I also heard a few comments around Hong Kong and Asia that also more parents are gifting their daughters and their children egg freezing so that at least there are some options for the future. But that also creates a bit of dilemma with the women, because if their parents have paid for it, then at a later age, it's like when you have your parents pay for the wedding, right? It's hard to tell them that you don't want X, Y, or Z. So I found that also very interesting. But do you think there is, in Asia particularly, some stigma and taboo around fertility and IVF? And do you see that changing now, or is that still the same? I mean, you're obviously from Hong Kong, you've lived in Taiwan. What are you seeing amongst the community?
It's changing, but slowly. There's still stigma surrounding IVF, infertility. And unfortunately, in Asia, they always blame it on the woman. I'm being very straightforward.
But yes, that's important. We are straightforward. We want to know exactly what's going on.
It's still a stigma, but I think it's changing. I was telling you that we conducted an interview with the couple, right? And obviously, they're willing to share the story on the internet. And I think the younger generation, there is less stigma. It's more accepting. I think it's happening everywhere. I think in 10 years, this is just going to be a norm.
That would be awesome. So quick question then about your clinical trials. So for your product approval, is it mandatory to conduct clinical trials? I assume yes, and get FDA approval as well? Or how does typically your product development cycle, what does it look like?
Yeah, so let's start with the product development cycle. It always starts with asking, is this something that the patients need and the doctor want? Is there a pain point? Is there a true demand for it? If the answer is yes, once we completed our market research, we speak to our research and development team about the feasibility and how much resources we should allocate to develop this product. From there, it's about development, validation, and finally, clinical trial. So before I go into the clinical trial, yes, I have to say, my team is awesome. They're amazing. I think they're some of the best in the field in Asia and even globally. They're great at planning. They're very methodical and they don't make mistakes. So this is really crucial for our start. If you make one mistake, it's a 3-month, 6-month delay. So going back to the clinical trial, with all our tests, we want to conduct clinical trial. Whether or not we're getting an FDA or we're not getting an FDA, clinical trial is very important to show the product's efficacy. Doctors are very hard to convince, trust me, right? So we have to conduct clinical trials to convince the doctor to show our efficacy. But clinical trials are very difficult in our field, in IVF. The reason is because patients, they're going through IVF, right? They're there to have babies. They're not there to do trials. They don't always want to be a part of a study that they might not receive the best new technology. So we have this called randomized trial. We divide the patient into a control arm and the solution arm. Everybody wants to be in the solution arm. No one's going to the
control the placebo. Arm, really. Yeah, exactly. Okay, I get it. Yes, never thought of that. But of course, for this product, I understand. Yes.
Yeah, if there's something new and it's free, I want to go into the solution arm.
Exactly. Well, and I'm also desperate to have a baby, right? So I just want to make sure that that happens either way.
Exactly. So it's been very difficult to enroll patient, to recruit patient into the study. That's a difficult part. And regarding the FDA, some of our products, for example, the egg device and the detection for hormones, we have to go through the regulatory process. We have to go through FDA. But some of our products are so novel that we speak to the authority several times, trying to find the right indication. And we're communicating the types of clinical trials that we should conduct to prove its efficacy. It's an ongoing process, but we approach it with transparency and by following correct process. It's a long road, but we're committed to.
Yeah, amazing. So you're conducting clinical trials in Vietnam. So maybe silly question, but why Vietnam? Why not Taiwan? Why not the Philippines? I mean, what makes you decide to do clinical trials in a country?
Actually, we're doing an Asia trial. So we have several sites in Taiwan, in Thailand, and Vietnam. And soon we're going to get a site in Korea and Japan. So it's more of an Asia randomized control trial. But since you mentioned Vietnam, it's a country that's growing. And believe it or not, I think it has, besides China and Japan, it might have the highest IVF treatment cycles in Asia.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yes. It's easier to recruit patients because they have just really high number of IVF cycles. But I have to check my number. I believe they could be the third on the list.
So just for the listeners, so the cycle means the amount of attempts they have to go through before they get pregnant, right?
Yes.
Wow, that's remarkable. That's also interesting to see how that works, why certain countries take so long. Does that have to do anything with the quality of the medical system or the doctors or the access to products? Or it's random?
So let me clarify a little bit. So the cycle could mean they're going through IVF process.
Okay.
Or they could mean their egg freezing cycle. So on average, I think in Asia, people go through 2 to 3 treatment cycles, not just Vietnam, but it's also case by case. The process of IVF treatment is quite similar across globally. It's just the types of technology that you're using or whether or not some tests are accessible in certain countries. Just for example, Hong Kong, IVF is expensive.
Yes, very.
If you don't pass certain criteria, you're not allowed to use PGTA. PGTA is a test that tests for embryo quality. Embryo quality, whether or not the DNA and materials are normal. So if you don't test for this, I think the success rate is going to be low. So I think it's not doctors in Hong Kong are less professional, but it's just the accessibility to the test. It's the same in Japan as well and Singapore.
So how open are the doctors to kind of use your tests and your products? I don't say you make it sound easy, but it's a very thoughtful process that you and Barry have been going through. We identify a problem. Here's a solution. But I'm sure there's kind of challenges, right? And I'm sure convincing doctors to use it is one of them. Can you tell a little bit more about the challenges?
Yeah, I'm sure you interview so many startups. Commercialization, I believe, is the toughest part for any startup, especially in the field of medicine. To be frank, adoption in IVF, our product is slow because doctors are very cautious. They're putting their success rate on the line. They're famous for their success rate, so they don't want to put it on the line. They want to see more evidence. So new technology like us, we have to show data, we have to show efficacy before they would use a test. That said, once the clinic sees benefit, they become incredible advocates. We have several clinics, doctors who have seen a higher success rate with failed implantation patients, and they're advocating our product to people, to their peers. And our early adopters have been really positive, and we're continuing to build evidence through trials to support broader adoption. So I think having a clinical trial completed, showing the efficacy is still key to really pushing our commercialization. But adoption has been slow, but we're very positive. The result that we're seeing, we're really excited.
Yeah, that's amazing. So with a lot of these things, it's just a question of time, right? You get like good use cases that you could use, good clinical data, good research, and then slowly but surely it happens. And okay, you started in 2022, so it's not that bad. You still have some time to go. Are there any other challenges that you're facing? Has it been hard for you to raise money?
The fundraising environment, it's very difficult for the past 3 years. But I've been really fortunate to have raised 2 rounds. The first round, we make significant progress. So the second round, we were able to get more investors. And I finished my fundraising last in December. It took a year and a half, but I think we were oversubscribed. So we have 2 years runway. We really want to make the fullest of it. Very lucky. So that's one challenge.
Sorry, just before you go to the next challenge, just on the fundraising. So your investors, are they typically from Asia or are they global investors? Just curious to see how investors are looking at companies from Taiwan these days.
Actually, all our investors are Asia-based. We have family offices. We have Singaporean investors. It's very difficult to get funding from the U.S. Even though we have Barry, who's
as good connections. Yes.
And who has a lot of experience, but it's very difficult because U.S. funding tend to support U.S.-based companies. So much innovation in the U.S., so many innovative companies in the U.S., they don't need to allocate to a company outside of the U.S. So for people who are trying to fundraise, like Asian-based company, I would say just focus your effort in Asia, unless you're building something truly amazing, that something that people across the world would see, then I think U.S. could be a path.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, I also see more U.S. companies actually reaching out to me to say, hey, could you help us fundraise from the family offices and the investors in Asia? So I think it is a tough environment out there. But sorry, I interrupted you. You were going to mention that there were some other challenges you had to go through other than fundraising.
One big challenge is obviously we're competing with companies that are more well-established. So that's very, very difficult, especially from a consumer side, because consumers, they want to use products from more established company. That's very reasonable. That's a very difficult challenge for us, but we're really doing great work and we're really doing clinical trial compared to other companies. We're one of the few companies who actually are conducting clinical trial to show our efficacy. So it's going to take time, but I think we will be successful against our competition in the future.
And your competition, are they Asia-based or are they global?
Both. I have a Taiwan-based company and we have global presence that's in Taiwan and also in Southeast Asia as well. So since we're currently commercializing in the whole Asia and Pacific area, so we're actually competing against international and local companies.
Wow, this has been such an interesting conversation, Eric. Thank you so much. I think we're almost at the end, but I did want to ask you, like, what advice would you give kind of anybody that is interested in entering the femtech or the women's health space as an entrepreneur based on your experience so far?
Good question. I think first, truly understand your audience. Women's health is so broad. You have to define exactly who you are serving and what they need, especially for male. But I think a lot of female founders, they really understand the pain points. So that's great. Second, you know, just solve real problems. Don't build tech for tech. Make sure that your solution addresses a true gap and really try to, related to the second point, really try to find out the real problem and whether it has been solved. There are a lot of opportunities in this field because women's health has been overlooked for many years. If a woman goes to a doctor and said, oh, she's having a headache, it's always being blamed on mental.
Yeah,
mental.
Exactly. Or here's an aspirin, you know, here's a Panadol. Good luck.
There are a lot of real problems. You just have to look for them and really find a solution. And I think that second and third, you know, build a strong network. For partners, you need investors, you need doctors. Doctors are going to tell you what's lacking in the space, you know, and finally, just be ready on the regulatory side.
Yeah, we didn't even touch on that, but that's obviously a whole other ball game to prepare for.
Yeah, it's not glamorous, right? But it's essential. So I think just be ready for it.
I just want to mention one thing, because you also mentioned your team, right? You said, without my team, it's going to be very hard. So how have you recruited them? What is the trick to building a good team?
Wow. So my team, they actually worked with me for several years in my previous company. They follow me to the current company. So I was very lucky to have met them. This is a very difficult question, I think. The key is finding that lead person. if you find the right person for that position, you'll be able to recruit other people. But you have to find the right person for that position. And I was very lucky to have worked with some of the best engineer, best scientists in my previous company. I was able to ask them to join me. They all like me, right? So they join me.
I'm sure they like you. And I think the other thing is, it's such a good point, right? So once you have that number one person and it's the right mindset, the right skills, the right capabilities, then that helps to bring everybody else on board. Well, Eric, thank you so much for being a guest on my podcast today. And thank you for everything that you do to make women's healthcare and particularly their fertility journey more accessible, more affordable, and more comfortable. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, and I wish you all the best of luck and success with the company. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.